But I have so many friends who are like, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, I'm in the hospital every day, and I don't understand this insurance and billing stuff. So it's just the system is not set up for patients to be able to do this on their own.
Welcome to That's Derm Good. I'm Janelle Ball, and I'm excited to bring you thought-provoking conversations about biologics, specialty medications, treatments, and so much more. I'll be chatting with some amazing guests about access, affordability, and advocacy. You're really going to enjoy this show.
Welcome to That's Derm Good. My guest today is Jenny Nolan, BCPA, an independent patient advocate. Welcome to That's Derm Good, Jenny. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited to talk to you. So you are a patient advocate. I feel like I've been kind of talking about this often, and, you know, how can we best advocate for our patients and, you know, making sure that they're able to get medication at a decent price and, you know, at an affordable price, but be able to stay on the therapy that they should be on. And, you know, what exactly do you do as a patient advocate?
So I'm in kind of a different role. I help my clients, patients with messed up medical bills and health insurance claims. So they could run the gamut. They could be hospital charges, they could be prescriptions, they could be medical office charges. So yeah, I help with corrected coding, appeals, fee negotiations, you name it.
Okay. Yeah. So how did you get into this?
So I started out in physician office management, and I managed an OB practice first. And that's when I kind of got involved in this whole billing nightmare, right? So every claim that we sent out the door, I would follow up on like 30 days later. Where's our money? Why hasn't this been processed? Why was it processed wrong? So at first it started out me trying to chase down money on behalf of my doctors, but through all that, I just realized what a mess it is. And not only were my doctors not getting paid correctly or on time, but then patients were being billed, you know, inappropriately. So I kind of became a little bit obsessed with it, went on to manage a counseling practice, and then I retired for a couple years back in 2016. My youngest kids had headed off to kindergarten, so I decided it would be a great time to be a stay-at-home mom since I didn't have any kids at home anymore. So I did that for a few years, but, you know, throughout the last 20 years or so, especially as we've had these higher deductible health plans, I started noticing myself, like, at least a third, no joke, a third of the medical bills that come into our house, and we don't have many, we're not like a sickly bunch or anything, so it's just routine stuff, they're wrong. And I would say to my husband, if I weren't here, you would just be paying these bills. He hates to owe people money. He doesn't know anything about medical billing. And he would literally just be writing checks and I would be rolling in my grave. So I started thinking, okay, I'm able to catch all of this because of my background. What about all the unfortunate people who don't have this background and they're literally just writing these checks? Like they have no idea. So they're either writing the check or they're just not paying the bill and they think it's going to go away and it ends up in collections and all that. So I would get on Facebook actually sometimes and like rant. I'd be like, oh my gosh, here's another messed up medical bill that I just received from XYZ. And people started saying, you should start a business where you help people with their medical bills. And I was like, who's going to pay me to do that? And then I just got on the Google machine and started like Googling it. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is an actual thing, a patient advocate. I'd never even really heard of it. And so I just kind of went from there. I took the certification exam in the fall of 2019 and then opened my doors February of 2020. So
what kind of certification was it?
So it's board certified patient advocate. It's through the Patient Advocate Certification Board, PACB. And yeah, it's a horrible multiple choice exam. It was really hard actually for me. I'm a good test taker, but it was very difficult. I passed. And then we have to have 30 hours of continuing education every 3 years to keep up our certification. That's how I got involved. Yeah.
So I found you on LinkedIn and I was like, wait a minute, this is really interesting. I want to find out more about this because, you know, it is difficult to know if your bills are incorrect or not. I mean,
yep.
How many people, I mean, like you were saying, a third of your bills that were coming in, but how often are there incorrect bills?
So there are estimates out there, if you Google it, that anywhere between 30 to 80% of medical bills have some kind of error. Now, you would have to really dig to get, I think, to that 80%. Like I'd have to request medical records from the hospital and line it up with an itemized statement and go, oh no, you only received 2 Advil and you got charged for 4, right? Like pretty much people don't dig that deep.
Yeah.
So I'm sure there are errors like that. But when you're talking about like the ones that I was noticing, they're not even hard really. Like the last one actually was a dermatology bill that I had to deal with last year on my own behalf. Took my son to the dermatologist for like a follow-up acne. He refilled his meds. And then the next month, the bill came in the mail and it said original charge, like $216, you owe $134.50. And I thought, well, the first thing I'm going to do, because this is what you should always do, is match it with your EOB, right? And so I got online with my insurance to find the EOB, and lo and behold, there wasn't one. So the claim had never gotten to my insurance. They had done some kind of like self-pay adjustment, got it down to the $134.50. And it took, believe it or not, for something so simple, 3 monthly billing cycles. I would call every month and say, it's still not on file with my insurance. It's still not on file with my insurance. Finally, they got it done right, and I only owed $85.40 or something like that. But that's the kind of stuff I'm talking about, where if you don't catch it, if you're not matching it with your EOB, I could have just paid the $134. And
so that $134 should have gone to your insurance, and they should have paid part of that.
The original charge, the $216, should have gone to my insurance. Yeah. And then there would have been an adjustment, and the rest would have been applied to my deductible, which is what ultimately happened, the $85. So I saved myself like, you know, $50, but
$50, and you know,
it's $50, especially if you don't owe it. It's not like I don't have the $50, but I don't owe the extra $50. Right. So I don't want to pay it. Yeah.
So do you think that that's probably one of the most common ones, or what other?
Probably.
Yeah.
Probably. And there are a million places where it can go wrong, right? From the moment you walk into the door and say, I've got a new insurance card. Does it really get scanned and put into your file? You know, there's so many places, probably from the initial phone call, you know, I want to schedule my son a new patient appointment. Do you take Cigna? And, you know, it can go wonky from there. So, and I know you talk a lot about like biologics and stuff and how you work as a coordinator. You know, that's another area. Not every practice has someone like you. Not every practice has someone who's focused only on pre-certification. So there's a million things that could go wrong there. It's just, there's a million places.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and we see this a lot on the pharmacy end, where patients are getting billed for medication and, you know, they're, say they have this automatic shipment set up, but the pharmacy is supposed to notify the patient what their copay is before they ship the medication. And I think a lot of times, you know, that right there, you know, the pharmacies, they'll ship out a medication and not tell the patient what their bill is. And then send them a, you know, $1,000 bill because they didn't apply a copay savings card or something like that. And then the patient calls and they're freaking out. And, you know, and I've seen that happen multiple times, you know, with the specialty pharmacy. And what ends up happening is we end up having to go back and say, you know, let's pull the call because you didn't tell the patient what their copay is, what their responsibility is first. And they're not supposed to do that. They're not supposed to ship a medication without getting that consent from the patient and the patient knowing exactly what that copay is supposed to be. It does happen, unfortunately, but you know, I feel like sometimes that could be not as difficult as identifying medical bills and seeing those come across, or, you know, we get medical bills that come in the mail and, you know, maybe we miss the first two and then they're like, oh, it's the third notice, you know, because we moved or something. So then you got to hurry up and go pay that bill and not look at what the bill is, what the charge is, what your EOB says. You know. Yeah, that's so important. What are some other things that we should be looking for when it comes to medical bills?
Well, I always start with obviously matching it up to your EOB. You're going to start there. Every time a bill comes in, you're going to match it up to your EOB. And I'll have friends reach out and they're like, I'm having a problem with this bill. And I said, okay, well, what does your EOB say? And they're like, what's the EOB? I threw those in the trash. And I'm like, oh, you know, don't throw those in the trash. They're so
right. It look like a bill sometimes.
It does look like a bill.
So people are like, wait, what is this? Why am I getting a bill?
Yeah, absolutely. So many things. Let's see. Just checking for like making sure your providers are in network. I know now with the marketplace, I don't think people understand how network specific those plans are. Like they don't have out of network benefits. You can't go out of state for and have your care covered unless it's a true emergency. And once they get you, you know, but by the time you're stabilized, then you got to get yourself out of the state and back home if you want your stuff covered. So just being familiar with your plan ahead of time is so important. And honestly, I think this stuff should be taught like as a college course, like, or high school, like we are all patients. We're all going to have to deal with this and nobody has any idea what's going on. So
I agree. I mean, that is so true. Even before I even got into healthcare, that was not, you know, anything that I really focused on or paid much attention to. I had no clue. And when it comes to the bills that are coming in or understanding an EOB, I mean, there's no direction on that.
Nope.
And, you know, even choosing plans too, it's like, okay, you get a job and it's like, all right, here we offer insurance, choose your plan. And you're like, what am I choosing?
Yes.
Right. I'm just going to look for the lowest copay. Is that the best, you know, is that the best choice? Who knows?
Right.
And it's hard. And then now too, because there's just so many different nuances and, you know, things that are covered and things that are not covered. And if it's in network or out of network, like there's just so much information that it can be so overwhelming. And you're just looking for coverage and you don't even think that, oh, well, if I have a chronic condition, do they cover that? Do I need to be looking for a plan that covers, you know, my psoriasis, you know, because at that point, if you're not on a biologic and you're probably not thinking that far in advance, you know, and wondering, are the medications that I might be prescribed going to be covered? Those are a lot of things that you don't think about. And even Medicare too, when you think about your Medicare supplemental plans and the re-verification time where now this time of year, where people are looking at new plans for the following year.
Yep. They don't understand. And then they're getting hit with those Medicare Advantage commercials that make you feel like you really need to be on Medicare Advantage, which is just not true. Well, if you think about it too, and I think I'm older than you, but like, I remember back when I was in high school, college, starting to go to the doctor on my own, right? My parents weren't with me, but I was still covered under my dad's insurance plan. And I could go to the doctor every day of the week if I wanted to and pay a $10 copay. There was none of this deductible stuff. And so we didn't have to know back then. We didn't care because we only owed $10, right? But now everything's changed to these high deductible health plans and everybody's like, holy crap, what just happened to me? I have no idea what's going on. And now the stakes are so much higher because we're talking about $5,000 deductibles and things like that instead of $10 copays.
So let's talk about that. Like, what are these high deductible plans and how do they work?
So high deductible health plans came about because insurance is so horribly expensive, right? And in our country, for whatever reason, it's our employer's responsibility to provide health insurance for us. And so premiums have gotten higher and higher and higher. And employers are like, oh my gosh, we can't afford to insure all of our employees and their spouses and kids. We need to shift some of this cost to them. So they can sign their people up for a lower premium plan, but higher deductible, right? And then the patient is carrying more of the burden, or they can make the patients pay part of the premiums also. So high deductible health plans are just, you know, for our family, I think ours is like 5,000. So other than routine visits, so things that are covered by the ACA, like routine physicals, mammograms, colonoscopies, once you're age 45, that kind of stuff, your insurance is not going to pay a dollar until you've met your deductible. So you're going to be responsible for any charges up to you hit your deductible. And then once you have hit your deductible, most people then owe a coinsurance. So then your insurance is going to pay 80% of the charge. You owe 20% until you hit an out-of-pocket maximum of like 10 grand or something. So that's how that works. And there are also studies, I can't even pretend to quote it right now, but most people can't afford their deductible. Like they just can't. Mm-hmm. Like you said, how do I pick this plan through my employer? They're signing up knowing that they have a $5,000 deductible, but also knowing that they don't have $5,000 in the bank. So their first trip mm-hmm. to the ER, bam, they're in debt automatically. It's crazy.
It is crazy because I remember when I was younger and I would look at plans and I'd be like, oh, I don't go to the doctor very often, so I don't need anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Until you get hit by a bus. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. You get in an accident or something. And I mean, a couple of emergency room runs and you're done. In debt.
Yeah. 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 For sure. Yep.
So how would you educate your kids to understand, you know, insurance, just basics, because there's so many layers and there's so much information, like just to dumb it down a little bit and to make it basic to say, okay, this is what you should look for. And this is what you should do when you get a bill.
Oh gosh. Okay. So with regard to picking insurance, I'd say if you've got a favorite OBGYN or a favorite primary care doctor or a favorite hospital, you're going to want to make sure that those are in network if you have any choice over the network. Sometimes with employer plans, you don't, right? Your employer's just picked out these and your only options are what deductible do you want to have, basically. So that's very important, knowing that you can afford the deductible that you've chosen, and then maybe socking away some money just in case something happens so that you do have some cash on hand. Funny that you asked that question because I've got them all scared to death to go to the ER. Like you have to be dying to go to the ER, else it can wait till Monday morning. So I can't tell you how many times, like my kids have, you know, one time one of my kids hurt himself playing baseball on a Saturday night. And my husband was like, we're taking him to the ER. And I was like, no, we're not. We're waiting till tomorrow. And then if he's alive tomorrow, we might consider urgent care, but then we'll just wait till Monday. And that's what we did. And it was like an office visit, you know, $100+ to our deductible.
So urgent care would be first choice before an ER visit.
For me. I mean, obviously I'm not going to sit here and give people medical advice. If you think you're having a heart attack or a stroke or something that's actually life threatening, the ER is for life threatening things. Mm-hmm. So that's what I always tell my kids. If you're bleeding from your finger, we can take you to the urgent care. They can do stitches, you know.
No, that makes sense.
It's funny because I think people think, how bad can this bill be? It's just a trip to the ER. And I can tell you, it's always going to be worse than what you thought.
Well, and then it always seems like there's one bill that comes out and then there's another bill. And you're like, wait a minute, I thought I already got a bill. And, you know, because I had back surgery last November and, you know, I thought I had the bill. And then I was like, wait a minute, what is this bill?
Yeah. So you're going to have your bill from the surgery center where you had the surgery or the hospital. You're going to have a bill from the surgeon who performed the surgery. You're going to have a bill from the anesthesiologist. Those for sure. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if there was a radiologist who read something. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's what it was. I was like, wait a minute, what is this? Because there was another appointment that I had prior to the surgery that was, I was like, oh man, this, it's a lot. Yeah. You don't think about all those things.
And so just listen, like you're involved in healthcare and you get these bills and you're still confused. I honestly, biologics are not my jam. I'd be like so confused. Like, I'm just going to call Janelle. But I have so many friends who are like, I'm a doctor, I'm a nurse, I'm in the hospital every day and I don't understand this insurance and billing stuff. So it's just, the system is not set up for patients to be able to do this on their own.
Right. So, and that's where you would come in. And I think, you know, how would somebody come to you and reach out to you to ask these questions and get advice on their bills? Or, you know, are they usually coming to you when they've got, you know, $5,000-$10,000 in debt?
Yeah. So unfortunately, a lot of them come to me when they've already been sent to collections. Like I said earlier, I think people think that things are just going to go away and they don't. So I know even our nonprofit hospitals, they will send you to collections. They will sue you in court and garnish your wages. Like they're not just going to be like, oh, you know, Janelle, she's so sweet. We're just going to write her bill off. Even if you tried paying, like, even if you decided, oh, I'm just going to pay like $50 a month, but you don't have a formal payment plan set up, they're going to send you anyway. So people find me just through Google, I think. I am listed on a couple different patient advocate websites. And then we do have a really good referral network because I'm a member of a few different advocacy groups where, you know, I might be a billing specialist, but, you know, Susie, her area of expertise is biologics, or maybe she helps people navigate cancer. And so there are clinical advocates mm-hmm. who help people coordinate their care amongst providers. And then a billing issue will come up and they'll say, hey, Jenny, can you step in here and help with this? But I think people unfortunately wait until, and it's never too late. I can still work on stuff that's in collections, but mm-hmm. a lot of times that's what finally gets them to make the phone call.
Yeah. Yeah. So you talk about medical billing errors, overpriced medical bills.
Yeah.
So what are overpriced medical bills then?
So that's another thing that I'm really passionate about is just, you know, there can be errors, but price transparency and the whole cost of healthcare mm-hmm. services now is just out of control. And so a lot of times I'll have patients send me a bill and they're like, oh my gosh, this bill is so high. There's got to be something wrong with it. And I'll pull mm-hmm. the EOB. I look at their benefits and I have to say, I'm sorry, there's nothing wrong with this bill. It's just ridiculously overpriced. So at that point, that's when we get into like negotiations. And there's a couple different websites and tools where I can pull up, okay, here's what an MRI should cost in Indianapolis versus what you charged. And I can pull up like what Medicare allows and offer, you know, a percentage over Medicare to try to mm-hmm. negotiate down. But yeah, a lot of times there's nothing wrong with them per se. They're just horribly overpriced. Mm-hmm. And that's where I think all this price transparency stuff that we're starting to see can really help, because people can, if they're not in emergency, they can shop around. That's not yeah. easy either, but it's possible. So.
So where are we seeing this price transparency?
Well, any hospital, there should have a machine readable file that you can access that has like every charge in their charge master. And it's supposed to tell their like self-pay rate, their minimum negotiated rate with insurance, their maximum negotiated rate with insurance. They should break it down by insurance. Here's what Aetna people have to pay for this. Here's what Anthem people pay. Here's what United Healthcare, Medicare. They kind of hide those. And then they're supposed to have like a shoppable tool of like their 300 most used CPT codes, where you mm-hmm. can go in and say, I'm going to schedule myself a mammogram. I want to know how much that costs first. That's a poor example because it should be covered in full if it's a screening mammogram. But pick another procedure, and you should be able to go in there and put in your insurance information, the procedure, and then come up with a price estimate. So,
okay.
Yeah. They're not all compliant. And again, it's not easy. It's a hassle, quite frankly. So,
right. Cause I mean, it's a lot of work, and you know, we're in the day and age where we want everything at our fingertips and we want to know right away. So a lot of times we're not going to do all that extra digging and research to try to figure out, you know, what's the best cost, especially when you're in a situation where, you know, oh yeah, you need to have this surgery done or you need to have this procedure done as soon as possible. And you know, it's, you're trusting your providers, you're trusting the people in healthcare because they're the experts and know what they're supposed to do. But, you know, in the same thing, they can make mistakes, and that billing, it's not necessarily the doctor that's doing it. It's the billing, you know, it's hard to
generally speaking, it's not the doctor's charges that are killing us. It's the hospital charges for sure. I mean, anything that you do inside of a hospital that you could do outside of a hospital is going to cost you way more in the hospital. So like I've started doing my mammograms, and like I had to have an MRI not too long ago, and I went to Northwest Radiology because it's a standalone radiology center. And I know And they're very upfront with their pricing at Northwest Radiology, which is fabulous. But I know that if I did the same MRI at the hospital down the street, it would cost me way more. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
What about, so, and you have a choice too. You have a choice.
As long as you're in network, you've got some fudge factor there, but you got to remember that, like, our big one that's right by me is IU Health. If I go see a doctor at IU Health, he's going to refer me to IU Health, not because he wants to keep all the money in the pot necessarily, you know, because that's what's familiar to him. That's the easiest. He can tap into the IU Health system and get my results immediately. So it's much easier for him to refer me to IU Health versus Northwest Radiology. Yeah. But I don't think patients realize that they have that freedom. And like you said, if you get into a situation where it's a life-saving surgery or it's a cancer treatment or something, you're initially just focused on staying alive. You're not thinking about how much is this going to cost.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. So as far as the, you know, transparency and within the hospital, you know, a lot of times I've gone into dermatology offices or other medical offices and, you know, they've got the prices there. They've got the self-pay price. Is that typical?
I don't think so at all. No, especially for a physician's practice because it's not a requirement for them. I think it is in a few states. I was on a, I can't remember. I think it was a surgeon who does like hernia repair maybe in Alaska. And they must be required to post some of their prices. I want to say it's like the top 10 most frequent procedures that they do. But that is very rare for someone to post their prices up front. And interesting that you say the self-pay price, because that's another thing. I don't think people realize that the price that you get with your insurance is not always the cheapest price. So sometimes self-pay is actually less expensive, but then you get into the whole thing about, well, if I pay self-pay, then it's not being applied to my deductible. So it could come back to bite you on the back end, but yeah.
So is the self-pay rate, is that typically, I feel like I've heard that it's supposed to be the Medicare rate.
No, not necessarily.
Not necessarily. Okay. Nope. I didn't know if it had to be like a certain amount. Like...
No. And they're just kind of across the board. Usually I feel like it's around a 30% discount off the charge master price.
Okay. And so is every state different?
With regard to?
As far as like what they're allowed to, what they have to post, like you were saying in Alaska, they might have to.
So that's physician office. So nationwide now the hospitals, anything that's an actual hospital is supposed to post their prices. So there may be some states that are requiring physicians to do that as well. I don't know of very many. And then ambulatory surgery centers, like they don't have to do that yet. So I think we're going to see more and more of that, which is good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is good. Wow. So what else do you see that is, you know, something that you work on outside of, you know, the transparency rates, the medical bills? What else are you working on as an advocate?
Oh, gosh. Right now with open enrollment, I've got a couple clients that I'm helping them choose their plan for next year. So we can do some of that, you know, anything. And every day is new. So anything that comes up regarding the cost of healthcare, like you name it, I've had to do it or I probably will at some point. Yeah.
So when it comes for open enrollment time, okay, what are some tips and things that you're sharing with your clients?
Again, it's about, I think with that, it making sure the providers that you want to see are in network, because within each state, you do have a few different options. I was working with a client yesterday in New York and she has her choice between Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield and a United Healthcare plan, and her OBGYN that she really wants to see is not in that Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield plan. So we're going to move her towards the United Healthcare. So then it just kind of gets down to, you know, they've got gold, silver, bronze plans. What deductible can you afford? Basically, what do you want your premiums to look like? Do you qualify for subsidies? And I don't get way deep into that. Patients, you know, they typically sign up on their own through their state's mm-hmm. website or healthcare.gov. But again, it making sure people are networked and just educating them on the plan. Like, here's what you're signing up for. You know, mm-hmm. you can't go to, I'm in Indiana. I can't just drive to Ohio to go to University of Cincinnati Hospital or whatever. It won't mm-hmm. be covered. So lots of education.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and that would go, would that be the same for maybe say I'm an independent contractor and I'm looking for a personal insurance that's, you know, obviously not going to be through an employer, yep. Like going through the marketplace.
You're going to go to the marketplace. Yeah. And while I don't love the limitations on the networks in the marketplace plans, they're still better than signing up for like a short-term policy or something that that's not ACA compliant, because those policies, they just kind of make up their own rules. That's where we get back to things being denied for pre-existing conditions. Mm-hmm. You know, I had one who got dinged. She signed up for a short-term insurance policy and there was a 7-day gap where she signed up like on the first of the month, but she wasn't technically covered until the 8th of the month. And lo and behold, she ended up in the ER on the 3rd of the month and none of that was covered. So they just kind of make up their own rules and it's hard to fight against it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So definitely the marketplace.
And what do you do in that case?
Oh gosh. In that case, we tried to appeal and then they denied our appeal. And then we negotiated her balances down and said, look, you know, I sent letters to the providers and said, I tried to appeal. Here's how she got stuck in this situation. It was nothing she could have anticipated. Can we work together and get this down to something more affordable?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you send the appeal letters in, you'll write the appeals to the insurance or?
Uh-huh. Yep.
Okay.
Yep. And then if that fails, usually there's a second round of appeals you can do. And then if that fails, that's when I go to the hospital then and say, okay, how can you work with us? Because we tried this. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
And this is all stuff that patients don't know about, mind you, because when they call the billing department is going to say, well, let's just sit you up on a 36-month payment plan. You know, they don't offer these other solutions. A lot of times they don't even remind you that if it's a nonprofit hospital, you can apply for financial assistance. Yeah. It's so hard to navigate on your own without knowing all these tricks.
It is. It really is. I mean, I'm going to have to just keep you on speed dial whenever.
Yeah, for sure.
When I have questions, because I mean, it's wild to see. And then the other question I was thinking was, what about COBRA? How does that work?
Okay.
And it's so probably COBRA, a mouthful, but.
Yeah. So COBRA is, I think if you work for a company that has 50 or more employees, don't quote me on that, and you lose your job, they are required to offer you COBRA. And that just means you're going to continue on the same insurance that you had through your employer, but you're taking on the full cost of the premium, which is super high, which typically your employer has paid all of that premium for you or part of the premium. And then you're suddenly going to take over the premium. And that's why you hear people say, oh my gosh, COBRA is so expensive. It's because you're taking on that premium. The benefits are the same. If you had a $2,500 deductible, you've still got that. You've still got 20% coinsurance, but you're assuming the cost of the premium.
Right. So, I mean, that's just something that, you know, if you want to have that basic, that coverage still while you're searching for another plan, then that's kind of almost last resort option.
Right. And you can compare that to what it would cost to go through the marketplace, because if you lose your job, that's one of the qualifying criteria for being able to sign up through the marketplace outside of open enrollment. So if you lose your benefits, you could always compare the two.
Yeah. So it's always good to keep them together though, like make sure there's not a gap in between the coverage.
Yes. Because you think nothing will happen during the gap. And I'm here to tell you that it does.
Of course. And, you know, and then the insurance companies are looking at it like, well, you know, this is a pre-existing condition. What exactly qualifies a pre-existing condition, and how come they never want to cover anything?
Well, so we've kind of gotten beyond that with the whole ACA that everybody calls it Obamacare. So for the past like 8 to 10 years, we haven't had to worry about that so much. Like most of our, like, you can't deny pre-existing conditions. And all that means is that you were treated for something before. And usually they go back, I don't know, like 5 years or something. So for instance, the short-term policies that I was speaking of, you sign up for a short-term insurance policy and I go to the physical therapist because my right hip is hurting. All of a sudden I'm going to get a denial for my claims because I've totally forgotten, but I actually saw the physical therapist 3 years ago and somehow they find this information. So they're going to deny it. They're going to be like, no, you've already had physical therapy for your hip and we're not going to pay for it because it's a pre-existing condition. Or maybe that's cancer, which you don't forget that you had cancer, but we're not going to cover that because you were already treated for it before you were effective on this policy. So for most of our employer plans now and anything that you get through the marketplace, you don't have to worry about that anymore.
You know what's crazy? I've seen that on some denial letters with some insurance, like when I'm doing prior authorizations for like some biologics, and say the patient was on a, you know, a insurance plan and then they switched to a different plan and I'm trying to get that continuation of therapy and I see a denial reason. It's because this this condition is pre-existing and, you know, they're like step therapy requirements or something.
Oh yeah.
And which is crazy.
Yeah. Well, I'd be interested in seeing what kind of policy that is. If it actually says pre-existing, I get the whole step therapy thing, but even though it's a pain in the rear, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. That'd be interesting to see.
Yeah. You know, it could be just the way it was worded, but I remember seeing, you know, this is a pre-existing condition.
Interesting.
There, and I'm like, wait a minute, what?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. There's so much to learn, and thank goodness for you and for what you're doing, because, you know, I mean, that's, it's just, it's a lot and people need help. And especially when it comes to the bills and, you know, just, I mean, I don't know how many people are millions, thousands of dollars in debt over medical bills.
Yep. A lot.
What are some resources that you refer patients to that are really in debt that need help and financial support?
Okay. I always go back to, did you apply for financial assistance through the hospital? Like I'll get on the internet and find out, is this hospital a nonprofit hospital? If it is, they are required to offer financial assistance and point the patients in that direction, even if they've gone to collections, and the hospital will post that they have a certain amount of time to fill out the financial assistance application. But I find that those deadlines don't really matter. You can still apply and get approved way after the fact. So that's one. If the process is overwhelming to file for financial assistance, because it is a pain, it's just like doing your taxes. You have to gather all that same information. You got to come up with your proof of income, your tax forms, your bills. Like it's a pain. If that's overwhelming, I refer to Dollar4. Are you familiar with Dollar4?
I've heard of them.
Yeah. So they're a nonprofit that they, their whole existence is to help people fill out financial assistance applications. And they can tell you, you know, if you'll, they've got like all the hospital's information in there and they can tell you almost immediately if you will qualify and then help you apply. So that's one that I refer to here in Indiana. And I'm not sure about other states, but we have a local nonprofit called the Indiana Health Fund that just started in 2020, and they take donations to help patients pay off medical bills. And the qualifications are pretty similar to most financial assistance policies through the hospitals, but these guys will help you take care of like a big physician's bill, because physician's office aren't required and don't always offer financial assistance. So Indiana Health Fund can help people pay for a large physician's bill or something like that. So
yeah,
you just got to kind of do some digging, because I've helped patients all over the country. So, you know, sometimes I have to hop on and see what's available in their state.
Yeah. You know, and I see, I've seen this before where, you know, we've get patients who, they need to be on these specialty medications, these biologics, and, you know, they may not qualify for a patient assistance program, or because they either make too much. But at the same time, it's like, okay, even though they may be making a lot, that's still a lot of money to be paying every single month for an injection.
Yeah.
So now it's like, you know, some of these people, even Medicare patients that don't qualify because maybe they've got, you know, a Roth IRA or something like that. But it's like, you know, now they've got to choose between their health and, you know, being in debt.
Their retirement fund. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's crazy. Yeah.
It is.
No, I've had people say to me, well, I guess I'm going to have to sell my house to pay this bill. And I'm like, mm-hmm. oh my gosh, no, like we'll figure something out.
Right.
Yeah. It's crazy.
Yeah. Wow. Well, thank you so much for joining me. And, you know, what is, I guess, other than making sure that your doctors are in network, and checking those EOBs, making sure that they match up with your bills, is there anything else that we can leave with our listeners, that they should be doing to make sure that, number one, their bills are correct and they're not going to go into debt over medical bills?
Yeah. I would say, again, I always go back to the EOB, so I won't say that again, but just familiarize yourself with your plan and know that there are options out there. Don't just ignore mm-hmm. these bills. They're not going to go away. Mm-hmm. We do have some new legislation that has allowed medical debt to be treated differently than other debt when it goes to collections. So we do have we've got a 1 year window from the time that a medical debt goes to collections that we can work on getting things resolved before it's reported to any of the credit bureaus. Yes. So it's not going to affect someone's credit for at least a year. So that's good. We've got time to work on it. Yeah. But yeah, just, I want them to know that there are people out there to help. There's people like you, there's people like me, there are clinical advocates. Like, the system is not made up for you to be able to do it on your own. And there are people out here that are happy to help.
That's amazing. Thank you so much. Yeah. I, you know, definitely will keep that in mind. And I will be telling everyone, get a health advocate to help you with your bills if you don't know, because it's so needed. And it was so great talking to you.
So great talking to you. I feel like we could talk for like 2 more hours.
Oh, yes, for sure. We'll have to do a part 2.
Yeah, sounds good.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll talk again soon.
Thanks for spending a few minutes with me and listening to That's Derm Good. You can expect new episodes of That's Derm Good every week. The podcast is available on your favorite app, including where you're listening right now. Subscribe to the podcast so you never miss a new episode. Bye.